Hi, it's really good to be talking to you again. This is Glenn Lowry at The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv. Happy to welcome as my guest Ann Althaus of the University of Wisconsin School of Law. And Ann, you've been blogging, no doubt, because you're a very active blogger, and you've been talking about all different kind of things going on. But I have to tell you, since today is February 14th, Valentine's Day, I just want to wish you a happy one.
Happy
if I may. Completely innocent and platonic happy Valentine's Day sent across the wire.
Do you like this holiday, or is this just oppressive to males everywhere?
All right, I'm going to confess to something, Anne. I love this holiday.
Okay. Aw, that's
I
sweet
love
of
this holiday. Good. I just like it's. I know it's saccharine sweet, and it's just too square for words. But I just like the idea of sending flowers to the ladies in my life, and that's my sister, my daughters, my granddaughter. You know.
Oh, that's sweet.
And things like that. And I just kind of like this idea of people, you know, who are hooked up together and connected with one another, having a day on which they celebrate the, you know, the binds, the ties that bind them, and the mm-hmm. aspirations that they share, and the fealty and the affections that they have for one another. Yeah, I love this day. What about you? Are you a big Valentine's
Day? Well, I met my now husband 5 years ago, and I really fell in love with him on the Friday the 13th before Valentine's Day in 2009. So I see the 13th as being kind of an anniversary for us, because it was a really big day in my late life. And
so I feel like married 5 years. You met your current husband 5 years ago, 2009.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's amazing. And when were you guys married?
In August 3rd, 2009.
Of the same year? Wow.
How'd I'm old. I don't have this kind of time to waste. You know, time flies.
I'm sure I'm older than you, and I know what you mean, but doggone it.
I'll bet you're not. I'll bet you're not older than me.
Are we going to tell? Because it's not supposed to ask.
I tell all the time. I'm proud of how old I am.
All right. I was born September 3rd, 1948. Match that.
Oh, I was born January 12th, 1951.
See?
So
gotcha.
You're my sister's, my older sister's age. So. All right. Well, I think you look fine for your age.
Well, I appreciate
that. So that's why
that.
I think you should be proud of your age once it's advanced, because
actually, it's one of the few things I've got left to be proud of. But
might as well put things in the pride category.
I definitely hear you about not having any time to waste. My wife of nearly 30 years passed away in 2011.
I know.
And, you know, I'm sitting around here, and believe me, anyone who's listening out there in Blogging Heads land, I'm not seeking a match, okay? But it
are
is.
Are you sure? You just said you love Valentine's Day.
But, well,
that
I
you're
did.
Holding up well.
And I do. I'm a romantic. What can I say? But I'm just saying.
Okay, well, I'll try to be a matchmaker for you, because what I hear is that you love, and that romance is wonderful, and
it is so sweet. It's the way we should be. I know it's not real life, you know. I know it's all kind of dreamy and soft. But there's just something about love and romance that just, you know, I don't think it gets any better than that, you know. Watching the sunset, when you're out on a cruise on the Mediterranean or whatever it is, and the sun is setting, and, you know, you've got this, and you've got a glass of champagne, and you're squeezing each other's hand, and you're anticipating, you know, the night ahead. No, come on. Doesn't get any better than that.
Well, I think that is real life. I don't think that is not the central thing about life. I think that is the most important thing about life. And so you shouldn't forget that. It doesn't have to be a particular vacation or a special occasion. I love just the normal days and normal life. So to me, a special holiday that forces you to focus on it in a different way, I don't necessarily like that. I like every day. I like the normal day. And I love living with my husband. I think it's just great to be married. I think it's wonderful.
Wow. Well, I'm very happy for you. That's a lovely, lovely story. I have an old friend. I won't mention his name because I don't want to embarrass him, but he's my age. And he's divorced, and it was a bitter and painful divorce. And I ran into him quite by happenstance at an event, sitting at a table having lunch, and he came over with a lady on his arm. And he introduced me to her, and he said, this is my the love of my life. We met 2 months ago. We met 2 months ago on Match.com. I'm not kidding. That's exactly the way he introduced her. And he was beaming. Okay? You would have thought the man won the lotto.
He did.
He was beaming, and he was so proud to tell me that he had met this woman on Match.com. I mean, and I thought, well, more power to you, my man. May you be happy. You know, live long and prosper. But it's a story of our time. You know, it would have never happened 5 years ago.
That's how people meet these days.
Yeah.
Well, I met my husband through my blog. So
Really?
Yeah, well, you know, there's old Blogging Heads episodes about this, Glenn. I had whole things with
Bob. Okay, I'm going back. I'm going to look you up. I'm going to check you out. I'll be prepared next time. But that's quite a story. You met him through your blog. Oh, come on. Blogging pays. I mean, that's the headline on that story.
Just like Match.com, the internet through blogging or maybe Blogging Heads allows you to kind of leap out beyond your immediate environment and find people who share similar ways of thinking about things or enjoy talking in certain sorts of way. You can find ways you can find people who are simpatico through speech, through the internet.
Somebody's going to write a great book about this one of these days. I don't think it's been done, but it will make the point that the technology, with all of its complexities and all of its pitfalls and so forth, by expanding our connectivity and expanding our options, has just made us plain off better off, you know, has just expanded because you can meet people that you never would have met. Now, there's a risk. You can meet people that you'd never want to meet. But, you know, by having those networks be suddenly global, And by having it go from hundreds or thousands to hundreds of thousands or millions or even, you know, tens of millions.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's a huge, huge, huge thing. And now it doesn't have to only be virtual. We can convert the connectivity of virtual into the sinew of real life relationship. So, yeah. Romance.
So everybody, and obviously there's someone out there for everyone. And with the internet, you're more likely to find them, especially if there's something very weird about what you are looking for. Or if you live in a place where there aren't people who are simpatico with you, or an isolated place. I live in the strange town of Madison, Wisconsin, so.
I hear you. Yeah. You wouldn't just want to go to the local bar and let that be the extent of your search.
Well, I can honestly say that I never went to a bar looking for someone in my entire life. I never once set foot in a bar by myself thinking I would find someone in a bar.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know how people do that. You might say it's kind of funny or embarrassing to use Match.com, but to me, the idea of going into a bar as a way to find somebody just seems dangerous.
No, I hear you.
No advice.
And I'm not sure going to an AA meeting to find somebody is any better. So we've got it bracketed. You don't want to go to the bar, and you neither do you want to go to the AA meeting looking for your husband. Anyway, so you want to talk about gender politics, and there was some stuff that was bugging you that's been going on of late. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I noticed that Nancy Pelosi said that she was going to try to make the midterm elections all about women. So this fall's election, there's an agenda of some kind to try to make women the subject of the election. And if it's going to be economics, it'll be a women's economic agenda. That's a quote. So I think it's very interesting the way the Democratic Party sees itself as having an advantage to portraying things in terms of women.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Well, there was the old war on women in the Romney Obama election,
right?
That seemed strained at first, but then seemed to actually be rather effective. I don't know how many times you can keep doing that before people think it's a ruse.
Well, a couple. The Republicans made it a little easy by having some candidates who said some stuff that was kind of difficult to defend.
Right.
So, you know, then that became something the press could seize on, and it became, you know, a trope. It became a device to deploy to isolate or to marginalize the candidates mm-hmm. or to raise questions. I guess I was going to say two things, what I think about it. One is there's this huge voting demographic. I was just at a meeting at the Ford Foundation on something, and this mm-hmm. guy, Ron Brownstein, who's a really smart political journalist, you may know him or of him, mm-hmm. Used to write for the Los Angeles Times. I think he was the Washington bureau chief of the LA Times for a long time. And he's now with the Atlantic Media Group, and he kind of handles politics for the Atlantic Monthly magazine and for the other properties of the Atlantic Media mm-hmm. Group. In any case, long story short is, he was giving the rundown on 2016, you know, what's up, what's down, who's in, who's out, Hillary, this or that, are the Republicans capable of coming, this or that. And it all came down to head counting about demography. I mm-hmm. his whole analysis, and I don't discredit it, I think it was very smart, was... this or that may work, this or that may happen, because when you look at the last 12 elections and you look at the trends and you see the percentage of Hispanics and the way they voted and voters under 15, over 35, mm-hmm. and college-educated women who moved to the left of this, I'm making a little bit of fun of it, but you see what I mean, categorized by demographic breakdown. It was all about gender, about class, about education, and about ethnicity.
Right.
And, you know, elections could pretty much be called on the basis of that. So they've probably done a calculation. You know, women voted this way, women voted that way. The Republicans haven't been getting the women's vote. They can't win unless the number of white women who vote for them is a certain number. So if you can frame the question as a way that will be disadvantageous to the Republicans on gender issues, you probably have yourself an advantage. So I think.
So now, yeah. I can see that there's always going to be a Republican that's going to say something stupid about women. So it's kind of a good bet. To just keep alive this idea that the Republicans are bad for women, or the Republicans don't really like women, or they're always going to let the mask slip and it's going to show that they disrespect women, and also that they'll take away certain basic reproductive freedoms that are important to women. So I think that that's always there to be taken off the back burner and used whenever one of these fools says something stupid, which is always going to happen. But the idea of framing the whole election around that seems to be we're going to keep generating these issues ourselves, portraying economic issues in terms of gender. And it seems to me that the Republican answer is usually to say, well, we think men and women are alike. They're all concerned about the economy. And just like on race, they want to get to race blind. I think they would like to say men and women are alike, and to just not speak in terms of these particular groups, because you could try to appeal to those groups without saying, hey, here's the part where we're appealing to you. We're saying women, or we're saying minorities, or we're saying something like that. You could just raise the issues. And why isn't it considered insulting that they're saying they're special women's issues? I mean, if what you cared about was women's equality, why wouldn't it seem counter equality to say, we're doing some special things for the women?
Sure.
Obviously, there's so many women that there are a lot of votes to be tapped, but why doesn't it alienate? I mean, I have some theories on this, but
no,
why aren't they afraid of alienating women by saying, here's stuff for you women?
Yeah, well, that's what Mike Huckabee tried to say relatively recently and famously when he made some comment about, you know, government, the sugar daddy or something like that. But you know what he was saying? He was saying, you know, I mean, I think what he was saying, as I listened to him, was don't patronize mm-hmm. women by imagining that you have to appeal to them in terms of handing out
right.
free contraceptives or whatever mm-hmm. it might be. You can't mm-hmm. reduce a woman as a political figure to a calculation about who is more or less likely to support her, her contraception choices. And mm-hmm. it got characterized as, another one of these unacceptable Neanderthal comments about women being in the... I'm not even sure what the criticism of Huckabee was as I stand here, because when I heard him make the comment, I thought exactly what you just said, which is you're appealing mm-hmm. to women as voters in, purely in terms of their gender, and that should be a patronizing way of coming to them. So I agree.
Well, you know,
that.
He used to...
I just want to say one other thing, Anne. And that is, put this on the table for you to comment on. I wanted to call to your attention, and our viewers, Rand Paul's tacit
right.
criticism of Hillary Clinton and direct criticism of Bill Clinton, where he says he doesn't understand how it is that Bill Clinton gets to go around and be an honorable defender of the Democratic Party line, which is a pro-woman line, when he took advantage of an intern in his office. And, you know, I'm not a pro-impeach Bill Clinton guy and whatnot, but I, you know, kind of find it hard to see that Rand Paul doesn't have a point there, okay? And so how is it that the press and everybody else can just forget about the exploitation of women when they're actually exploited and yet are prepared to, you know, level their howitzers of criticism on any Republican who might say something that could be construed as anti-woman who hasn't been messing around with the interns who were under his charge? So,
well, the simplest explanation is that the media are primarily on the side of the Democrats. They're helping the Democratic Party. And to the extent that they act like they're pro-women's rights, that's only because it coincides with the Democratic Party. And any time it stops coinciding, they switch to being for the Democratic Party. So that's when you can tell that they're really about Democratic Party politics. And they only care about women because that's a means to the end. It's not the end in itself. I think we saw that clearly when President Clinton was president. It was just a few years after the whole Clarence Thomas Anita Hill business, in which everyone was supposed to be very aware and concerned about sexual harassment in the workplace. And then everybody immediately forgot about it so soon after that to support Clinton and treat. I mean, I remember what during the Clarence Thomas hearings when they when liberals were trying to there were Republicans who were trying to discredit Anita Hill, calling her a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty.
I remember that line. It's hard to forget that one.
So then a few years later,
but that guy recanted,
when Hillary
didn't he?
Clinton,
I'm sorry, when, go ahead.
Yeah, that was, the person who said that later switched sides because it was talk about things that are convenient for journalists. I think that happened. But a few years later, and if we look at these Hillary Clinton papers that are available, I guess it's at some university, this her a best friend of hers took notes and they've been reported lately. But she, I mean, she basically had the same take on Monica Lewinsky to portray this woman as a crazy and Looney Tunes and so forth. So a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty just turned right into something that could be said about the women who were accusing Bill Clinton. And that went down just fine. So something that was completely horrible to have said about Anita Hill became something that was immediately, just so soon after that, deployed against Bill Clinton's, the women that Bill Clinton had become involved with. So
I think there's merit in what you say.
Brought to light that it was about the media supporting the Democrats. I mean, that's the simple, that's Occam's razor.
And I believe there's merit in what you say. I think you can discern. I mean, as far as I know, what Clarence Thomas did, if he did it, what he was accused of having done was basically flirt and ask this woman out and make suggestive comments to which she was not responsive. I mean, he didn't actually, you know, touch her, you know, anything like that. But
he was
I think
supervisor.
It should be said. I think it should be said, whatever Monica Lewinsky's, you know, obsessive interest, such as it might have been portrayed by some defenders of President Bill Clinton in this powerful man who is chief executive of the U.S. and, you know, leader of the free world and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, however much she might have shook her buns in his face or whatever it might have been that tipped him down that path, his behavior can't be defended in any way, shape, or form. You know? I mean, she's a child. Okay, you're not supposed to touch her.
To me.
You're not supposed to touch her, man.
Oh. Wait, Monica Lewinsky was an adult. Monica Lewinsky.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't mean child in the literal sense of child molestation. You know what I mean? She's a little girl. Maybe I'm being condescending right now. You know, she's a full-grown woman in the flower of her sexuality. But what I mean to say is, you don't touch her.
Well, I think the problem is with sexual... I think the problem with sexual harassment in the workplace, there may be some people who volunteer and want to have sex with the boss and enthusiastically pursue him, showing their underpants or whatever they do. And he should know better than to get involved with someone younger and to take advantage of his stature to take sexual, have his sexual
pleasure. That's what I'm saying.
But that's, to me, that's more ordinary than the problem of creating inequality in the workplace by having a powerful person who can then make selections among the people who are working there. Some people don't have a shot at getting favor in the workplace by interacting sexually with the boss, the people who are not the same sex, who aren't the sex he's attracted to.
Yeah.
If it's a man attracted to women, the women who aren't attractive, or women who just don't do that sort of thing. The workplace should be a meritocracy for the people who are there and the people who appropriate, especially a position of trust that the public has voted him into, put him into, for him to repurpose that trust so that he can find sexual pleasure for himself is betraying the trust that the people have, and it's changing the workplace into a different environment that isn't based on the work that you do and doesn't give everyone a fair shot. So to me, it's not as much as Rand Paul and his wife said that he was predatory on this young woman, although obviously that's an offense to Hillary, and she did stay with him, and she did call Monica Lewinsky Looney Tunes and so forth and was out to destroy her credibility. I think the greater problem is the problem to everyone else in the workplace, everyone who doesn't play in that game.
Yeah.
He's president not as a personal potentate. He's president because he's elected to do a job, and he should handle that responsibility in a trustworthy way that's especially careful about the workplace environment. That if you care about equality,
I couldn't agree more, Anne. I could not agree more with what you're saying here about workplace, the appropriate inappropriateness of this kind of thing in the workplace. And I might just add, it's also true about the classroom. Okay, I mean, that is, as a college professor, one has a position of esteem and influence in young people's lives, and they may become infatuated and they may offer themselves to you, and you should not touch them, you know?
And it used to be
you
the
abuse
norm,
your authority, so and you debase the currency of the thing that you're doing, you know, the whole, and I agree about this favoritism point. I think that's really very important. The idea that you're attractive and appeal to me, so I give you more of my attention when I'm actually attending to my duties as a professor than I would another student who didn't appeal. I mean, come on, there's something deeply corrupt about that. So, yeah.
And it used to be the norm before the development of thinking about sexual harassment. It used to be the norm, especially, I think, among college professors or so. That was the mythology of it. I read there was a famous article years ago in the Atlantic or someplace like that with a professor justifying what he was giving to these young women who weren't getting enough intellectual stimulation out of men their age, and that they would be elevated in life through their interaction with the professor. Obviously, there are a lot of professors who married their former students, but that was, you know, in the olden days, there were men who thought that having a position as a professor, one of the benefits
that was
of the
a
job,
perk.
One of the perks
that was a perk
was that they could decide which women they were interested in and see if they could get them, or talk in the faculty lounge about who were the women who they would be interested in having sex with and so forth. And, you know, that's just changed so much over the years. So anybody that thinks like that doesn't openly talk about it anymore.
That's true. Although what has not changed over the years is the fact that the chemistry of sexuality plays a vital role in all of these institutions. It plays a vital role in the workplace, and, you know, the kind of undertow, the kind of tacit, implicit dynamic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there. Come on, we can't deny it. I mean, we are sexual beings, and men and women, powerful men and powerful women, unequally placed men and women interacting in situations that enters in, whether it's acted on, whether it's made explicit, whether there's a quid pro quo, whether there's a, you know, discriminatory favoritism, nonetheless, it's there. And it seems to me that, you know, part of the problem for regulation of this is drawing a line between the unavoidable, the kind of necessary role that gender-based sexual attractions plays in human interaction, including interaction in workplace and the classroom, and going over the line, you know, saying when it is that whatever it is more than what the institution can tolerate or can bear. So,
Well, what do you think of, there are some cultures where the women simply stay home and you don't mix in the workplace, and so that those temptations aren't there. Obviously, in America, we think we're beyond that stage and that we're better than the cultures that
I think the
but
argument
does cause there to be a challenge to people's character on a continual basis to find some way to interact that's friendly and comfortable, but doesn't cross over the line so that people lose control of what they're doing. And they obviously do lose control all the time.
Well,
so
I was just going to say,
that's part of what we have.
I was just going to say, I think some of these conservative and fundamentalist communities that we can, you know, from the Amish or the conservative or Orthodox Jewish or the deeply conservative fundamentalist Protestant or Catholic or whatever, the Muslim, you know, the sort of, you know, women in the beekeeper suits, as Bill Maher used to put it. But, you know, this, what you might think of as a kind of bizarre and perverse phobia of the sexuality, maybe partly where that's coming from is a recognition of the fact of the slippery slope, you know, a recognition of the the kind of ineluctable nature of this attraction and this chemistry. And so you need to put them on different sides of the room and to clothe them in, you know, from head to toe and drape them and, you know, whatever. Of course, now,
right,
this disempowers women. This disempowers women in a fundamental way, right? I mean, it's not men who are walking around. It's not men who are walking around blinkered so they're not tempted to look at the woman's bosom. It's the woman who has to cover herself in a cloth, a sack, in order not to tempt the man into looking at her. So, you know, there's a deep problem with these solutions, but you might see how they're motivated.
Well, there are different ways to deal with the fact that people have sexual feelings. And one is this extreme separation, and which to some extent treats women as if they're so powerfully sexual that they have to be put somewhere where they won't cause men to, I guess, lose their minds or something like that. It's really a statement about the weakness of men in a sense. So then in our situation where we mix the sexes, obviously, we're saying we think people can control themselves and that they can understand the values of equality and the importance of access to the workplace for women, and that you are then supposed to behave according to certain standards. And then there's a debate about what those standards should be. But a lot of demands are put on people to overcome. You know, we're in a society where, on the one hand, we're expected to have lots of sexual feelings and to have it burst to the surface very easily. We're supposed to be very sexual, expressive in the right place, and then be able to somehow completely control it in the workplace. And very strong demands are placed on people to live up. I was just reading this article in The New Yorker about the sort of sexism, this casual or microaggressive sexism that occurs all the time to women. And there will be a categorization of, you know, just the most almost innocuous compliments or looking at someone or saying they look nice or you like their clothes or something. Like, almost anything could be an offense. And almost at some point, maybe that's too repressive. But I think it's important to focus on what is really wrong in sexual harassment.
Let me ask you this.
I think that's the inequality in the workplace, not the fact that people are human and are animals and have sexual feelings, and that they want to have some kind of social playfulness to the workplace, but that they're creating an atmosphere of inequality.
Got it.
I want
to ask you something else. Okay, so the French have a different way of dealing with these issues. The Italians have a different way of dealing with these issues. No, those are not the same things. Let's stay with the French. So the president of France was just in the country. He is estranged from his wife and publicly.
He wasn't married to her.
Pardon?
That wasn't his wife.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They weren't married.
Thank you.
So he's estranged from the other woman.
Okay, I'm sorry. He's estranged from his partner, his partner of some years, to whom he was not married, but with whom he was hooked up because he had taken up with a younger woman, and that became public. He was known to be seen taking a scooter out of the Elysee Paris palace in order to rendezvous with this younger woman. And so he came for a state dinner and he was unaccompanied. But I mangled the facts. I apologize. But in any case, I'm just trying to point at the fact that French culture, political and social and ethical, seems to take a very different view about the propriety of, let me just say, noticing that a woman whom I'm working with looks really good, I mean, amazingly beautiful, and wanting in the course of doing business to not let that go unnoticed and unremarked. You're an extraordinarily attractive woman, or my goodness, look at this dress that you're wearing, or whatever it might be. whatever. And to have that be said in a way that's suave and, you know, smooth, and that's maybe a little tainted, tainted with a little flirtation, but, you know, that's part of life. No, I haven't asked you to go to bed with me, and I may never do so. You know, it would be inappropriate for me to do, but the idea that I'm thinking that it wouldn't be such a bad idea to be in bed with you is not an unacceptable idea for me to allow you to think that I'm thinking, you know what I mean? And you don't take offense at that. You understand that as a part of life, and we move on as mature adults. I mean, there just seems to me to be a different way of doing it.
Well, it's really hard in America to say, could we all please stop taking offense at this? Because it seems to me that the discourse in America is all about all the different ways in which we could take offense. And you can't just get over it. Did you see the clip of Samuel L. Jackson with some news guy who mistook him for Lawrence Fishburne?
I saw the tail end of it. He was pissed off, Samuel L. Jackson was, that... Oh, just because we're both black, we're supposed to be the same, man. Right. Lawrence Fishburne is one person, Samuel Jackson is another. We're different people. You can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that.
It was very, and so then the and so the interviewer is like, he apologized, and then he starts to move on. And the funniest part to me was when he tried to move on to the next question, after saying he was sorry, Samuel L. Jackson said, oh, hell no. In other words, I'm not going on to the next question. I need to go on about this some more.
Yeah.
So, And it's sort of, well, he already apologized and it was just a mistake. So why do you have to take that? But he did, he's choosing to lay down the offense at that point and to run with it. And so you can never really control people in America about when they're going to stop talking about being offended and the level of demand they're going to make on other people not to give offense. I mean, it seems to me that most of the back and forth that we experience, a lot of it, in America is about these challenges not to be offended. But when you add the party politics into that, and you have a party that's so deeply invested in this war on women and thinks it can win in that war, then if you say something like what Mike Huckabee said when he thought he was being amusing and using some colorful language, of course they're going to take offense. They're going to take offense whether they're offended or not, because offense is one of the rhetorical moves that's been effective. They're never going to stop, in short.
Preach on, preach on. I think you got it. I mean, I believe, I think you're exactly right, Ann Aldhouse, on this one. I mean, we are perhaps too quick to offend, and you're right. That card, the offense card, I'm offended, you know. How dare you say this about me, woman, black, gay, Jew, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean,
maybe,
it is a very frequently encountered move in American debate. So, yeah, right.
So I think maybe what's needed is just a strong counter move. I think that maybe I'd like to see more pushing of freedom of speech, for example, this idea of comedy, of being not repressed, being able to speak more freely, rather than trying to get repress the other side, stop being offended at every little thing, more of an offense in terms of free speech, rather than trying to get, you'll never get people to shut up. So I think more speech is the best approach.
Let's take a few minutes to talk about something related, but on a slightly different theme. So you were talking to me before we started recording about what was going on at Facebook, was it? About gender identity specification.
Yeah.
What's up with that? I mean, it looks like we're entering into a brave new world here.
Facebook has, when you fill out your profile, it would have male, female as your choices. But now you can pick custom gender, and then that opens up a menu with 50 items, 50 different possible. Of course, now to me, I think what they're really doing is they're getting promotion. Facebook is losing young people and it's being overwhelmed by the older folks.
Like, yeah. Okay. So they've got a long-term problem.
Everybody's mother is there.
I'm sorry. But yeah, because that's where the fat part of the market is, right? And that's where the prediction of future...
Yeah.
Future value is, so you want to attract the young people. So, what are some
part
of these 50 flavors of gender? I'm old.
Agender,
androgyne. Say it again.
Agender, androgyne, agender, like not like asexual, agender.
Oh, agender. Okay, no gender. I see. Androgynous.
Androgyne, androgynous, bigender, gender fluid, gender nonconforming, gender questioning, gender variant, gender queer, intersex, male to female, neither, pangender, wow. trans, transmasculine, two-spirit. I don't know what some of these are. I don't know what two-spirit means, but I think to me what they're really doing is, I think that that's a they're trying to attract young people and deflect repel older people and make Facebook seem young again. And this is kind of a viral thing that everyone's, I'm talking about it. So I think that it's kind of a publicity stunt, but it's a way of signaling to the young people that they're actually hip and young and cool, and the squares need to go elsewhere. And grandma and grandpa, mom and dad ought to get off of Facebook because they don't share your values.
Okay, so that definitely means me and you, right? I mean, we're out now. Is that? I mean, I have to confess, it does seem a bit weird. I mean, I'm not offended as much as I'm bemused. And I'm wondering, I mean, what fraction of the population, okay, I'm going to declare myself a liberal here. I'm going to say, let's live and let live, all right? I'm going to make room in my philosophy for a person who is neither male nor female, or who is both male and female, or who was male now and is female then. I can make room in my philosophy for that. But I'm just wondering, what fraction of all people could not check a male or female box without giving it a second thought? I mean, you know, I'm a man.
Well, it's
a, I've been
it's
a man
a
all my life.
Issue.
Now, it's got to be, that's got to be like, what, 95, 98% of the people? So, you know, I don't get it. A 50 boxes for 2% or 3% of the population who are ambivalent or ambiguous or queer, if I may say so,
the
about
whole
their
transsexual.
I don't get it.
This issue, I think it works as a wedge issue. It's more of an idea than applying to particular people. People who it applies to have, very sympathetic problem or problems that are very sympathetic to some people and that are very off-putting, or I don't want to have to think about that, to other people. So it becomes a wedge issue that you can talk about. It defines people. It excludes, it includes the whole idea that we're speaking about this at all or taking it seriously or being empathetic about it. That divides people up. That works as a wedge issue.
Okay, so now I've been very interested of late in things going on in Africa, in politics and culture. I'm at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown as an affiliate now, and I'm trying to educate myself about international affairs. Just something interesting to do. I've always worked on the U.S., and I'm taking a somewhat broader cast. And, of course, issues about how other countries deal, you know, with homosexuality, you know, criminalizing gay sex and things like this, especially in Africa, have come to the fore. And also with the Olympics and with the anti-quote gay propaganda, close quote, legislation that the Russians and Vladimir Putin have enacted and the world's response to that. I'm made to think about these things. One argument that I've heard from some African scholars whom I respect, these people are not Neanderthals by any means, and they are open-minded people, is, you know, this is an extremely complex area about human sexuality and human gender identity and all of that. The latter-day sensibility of the West, New York, London, Paris, and so forth, in the last 20 or 30 years, let's say since Stonewall, okay, has moved in one direction. But to put yourselves up on a high horse and start lecturing to the rest of the world about these things is if you've discovered, you know, a path in the forest that's gold paved and leads off to truth, is arrogant and a kind of imperialistic in the extreme. No, we don't accept your latter day liberality about these matters. We can sort it out for ourselves. We have deep traditions of humane dealing with all of these kinds of variations of human expression, and we'll be fine, thank you. We don't need you to come in here and tell us how to deal with our things. So now, I'm not defending. I just want to be don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not defending, let's say, a Uganda where, you know, you pass a law, you're going to put somebody to death for being gay or something like that. That's abhorrent and extreme. That's like stoning an adulterer to death or cutting off the hand of somebody stealing a loaf of bread. It's barbarity, okay? I reject it categorically. But Africans are not all benighted people who need to be led out of a dark age by, you know, European liberal missionaries who've discovered what human rights are. And neither are Russians, I would say. And I wonder how you react to that.
Well, I think it's not. It's as with any question where you think you know the truth, like you must accept Jesus to go to heaven. I mean, there are all kinds of things about which people feel certain is true. And you may feel like I need to tell everybody to save them before it's too late. But there's a lot of that going around in human history. And maybe we should be a little humble about whether we really know what we think we know, and also what's effective. I mean, just going and telling people what they need to believe, bringing it in from the outside isn't even going to be effective. So I could sort of see that when we're not talking about saving people from being stoned to death and things like that, that are emergencies, that some of this cultural relativism that you're talking about is an appropriate humility that we should have, because after all, there are things that if you go back 10 years before in American culture, we were saying completely different things. I mean, I thought it was really weird with respect to gay marriage that you had Obama saying he was opposed to it when he was running for president. And then later he changed his mind. And then once he changed his mind, everybody was supposed to be at the very point on the continuum where he had arrived at when he had been somewhere else quite recently.
By the way, our press corps allowed him to get away with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I absolutely agree with you about that. And I mean, and you know, people know that I have criticized President Obama, and I always get flack in the comments at blogging heads about, oh, Lowry hates Obama, blah blah blah. But I'm right about this. You and I, Anna, are certainly right about it. I mean, there's a kind of self-righteousness about it, right? I mean, there's kind of, you know, I mean, come on, please don't lecture me about this. I thought you went to Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church for 20 years. You know, I know what's preached in those churches because I go to one of them. Okay? So those are not bad people in those churches, but they are not on the same page as you right now. So now you got on that page and you're going to go around, you know, shaking your finger in the faces of these people? I mean, please. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, I mean, so I have a problem with that. I agree with that.
Now, what did you think of the whole Duck Dynasty?
I think that they generate a lot of advertising revenues for
here was someone saying something.
I can't even remember the name of the station now. A&E. Is it
Arts
A&E?
And Entertainment. A&E, Arts and Entertainment. But, I mean, here was someone saying something that was really just standard talk, and it wasn't really hateful. It was just basically saying, I like female genitalia. I'm a male, and that seems like the right answer for me. And obviously, a lot of people feel like that. That's just a kind of mundane and funny expression of what it feels like to be a heterosexual man, I assume. And yet he was pilloried for it, and it was portrayed as being hateful and bigoted. You know, this jacking up of the characterization of what the person is doing, and taking someone who's basically a good person and presenting him as if he's a bigot, as if he's hateful.
So you were just asking me about Duck Dynasty. Yeah, I listened to that. What the guy said, you know, I mean, you know, he's a good old boy out of a certain location within American society where you wouldn't be at all surprised to hear people think like that, talk like that. I don't think, based on what he said, that I could rightly infer that he was a bad person or a malicious person or a hateful person. He was just not a politically correct person within the, you know, I mean, he's not the person that you're going to invite to come over to have tea when, you know, you have the faculty club event or something like that. So, I the reason you were watching the show was because he was a good old boy, he and his family. I thought that people were getting off on that. I thought that's what they were buying when they tuned in.
But they weren't expressing any kind of hate with respect to this group or that group or with respect to women. They are basically nice people who are having a good time. You know, one thing about that show, it cost me to watch a few episodes of that show. And one thing that impressed me is that here are people doing work that they basically enjoy doing, interacting with each other in the workplace and having a great time and enjoying life doing the things that they like. They're not out to offend anyone, or I just didn't see to take them out of that milieu where they're presented in the show and to present them as ogres.
Yeah, I think that's. I agree with you, Anne. I do. There's another show. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a bunch of guys who fix cars. They take cars, they break them down, they remake them, and they fix them. I don't watch it regularly, but I've caught it a few times. And you know, it's. I don't know if it's Tennessee or Florida or Mississippi or Arkansas, wherever it is. It's in the South. It's in the mountains. Whatever. These guys are overweight, you know, they drink a lot of beer, they use swear words, they probably got pinup pictures pasted to their locker room door or whatever. And, you know, and they fix these cars. And then they, like, shoot the breeze in between. And, you know, it's what it is. I mean, you know, not everybody is interested in it, but, you know, it is what it is. And I mean, if you're going to be tolerant, can't you be tolerant of that?
Right. And isn't it interesting that, I agree. And I think that our fascination with seeing people interacting in the workplace, people who know how to do something, make something, fix something. I think a lot of people in America don't have that. You know, they're filling out forms, working for the government, doing intellectual work, serving people in restaurants and so on. But to really be able to fix a car, take a car apart, manufacture a duck call or whatever one does. That's a milieu that most people don't get to experience. And I think people enjoy just looking in on that and seeing how, I know a lot of it's fake and they obviously are redoing the scenes and making them funnier and being characters and kind of playing a role. But I think people really enjoy that kind of, that's filling a need that Americans have in some way.
I think
it's worth trying to think carefully about what need that is fulfilling for us.
I think I identifying a really important point. I think that's why I watch. Those guys know how to install the carpet on the floor of the car. They know how to get the thing to fit.
Yeah.
They know how to diagnose the problem with the engine. I mean, it really is kind of inspiring to see something come out of nothing, to see the objects that you take for granted in your daily life, but you have no clue how they are put together or how to put them back together, that they're people who take their hands and they sit down and they put them back together again. I mean, that's pretty cool. So, you're right about that.
You know, there was this Pew report that came out recently about that was reported as women marrying down. More women are marrying down. And that was, I took offense at that because the idea is that you're marrying down if you marry someone who doesn't have the same level of educational degree. Yeah. But there are all of these, and then there are all these women that don't have husbands. This is getting back to the Valentine's Day theme. But
particularly African-American women, not only them, but, you know, it's a very widespread phenomenon amongst African-American women.
But,
go on.
So people get educated, and women may take to education more than men do. The classroom, especially, in high school, in elementary school, it's often run by women. It's a very female. It may be appealing to females in a way that it's difficult for males and boys who end up with all of these hyperactivity diagnoses and so on. And college seems to be much higher number of women going and graduating, getting advanced degrees and so on. And so then there were a lot of single women, but then there are also women who marry in a way that got characterized in this report as marrying down, because women were marrying men that came from a less high educational background than they have. But in fact, these men who are able to do things, make the things that we need, you know, put in the wood floor and make it look great and fix the cars, do the masonry and so forth. Those are good businesses. Those are things that people need.
Can I just
mention?
It's
not that the men who do that aren't smart.
I want to mention
Valentine's Day. It may be the
smartest
thing you could do. Yes.
I'm sorry to talk over you, dear. I just wanted to mention on Valentine's Day that some of the things that those men can do are done in the bedroom. Okay? I said
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Right?
Yes. I said it.
I did a blog post on, the whole thing of men who can do things with their hands, that does have a sexual connotation. I did a blog post on this, and I got a lot of comments that took that approach. How about men that know how to do things, who can look at physical reality and interact with it?
I want to mention one other thing, which is Terry McMillan, the writer. You may know some of her novels like, you know, Waiting to Exhale, How Stella Got Her Groove Back. She's a big African-American female writer. But the book of hers that and I've read her books, and the book of hers that I loved most is her first, if I'm not mistaken, and it's called Disappearing Acts. And it's about the relationship mm-hmm. between, I think, a master's degree, school teacher type, 30-something African-American woman who partners up with a guy who just got out of prison and he works with his hands, literally. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, getting a construction job, dealing with racism out there. Will he keep his job and go back and forth? And he's moving mm-hmm. in and out of her life. And how can they find a relationship? How can they keep it? He's unfaithful to her. How can they reestablish trust? It's all about that. And it's very much about this thing that, you know, the difference in their education. I mean, he's like a high school dropout guy who was an ex-con, okay? And she's got mm-hmm. a master's degree. And yet, there are deep needs in her life that he's fulfilling, as she is deeply fulfilling in his own life. And there's the idea that they could be together is not crazy. There's something heroic about it, you know? I think
and
she captures
that very
well.
I wouldn't assume that a man who goes into a trade or who learns a craft or who starts a business and gets out of the education system early, that is not a smart man. That might be the smartest thing you could do today. And so this it's sad that women have this idea that you need to marry up in the sense of, it's really social class snobbery, I think. You should want a lawyer. You don't really want a lawyer. I think you'd be better off with the mason.
The plumber or the carpenter or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've called a plumber to your house lately, but believe me, it's it cost you a bit to get him to come over here.
Because people need that. You know, we had some masonry work that our front stoop was crumbling apart. We needed to get the mason. It was hard to find a mason, mm-hmm. you know. We were very grateful when he would come over, and we paid whatever the price was. We could only find one, these two, father and son, I think they were, who did it. And we were glad to have them. They did a fine job. And it's just like, well, why are people so enamored of education? What is going on with this? I mean, you can be an autodidact and learn a lot. People read the internet all the time and, educate themselves, and there's the Khan Institute and all of these sorts of things. You can do all your own reading and learn about a lot of things. But what should you really systematically learn how to do is going to college and getting a degree in some humanities major or something like that really a good idea compared to learning something technical and really being able to do it? I think the smartest, what do smart people do? Is it smart to go to college? And anyway, I'm just saying that if women are, maybe women are drawn into education and to intellectual topics in a way that's working for them more likely than for a lot of the men. And if you're a woman looking for love and looking for someone who would be a satisfying partner, this sad snobbery about what would be up and what would be down is, I think, impairing a lot of happiness that, you know, you need to get some before it's all over. And then it's all down from there.
Younger women who may be out there in Blogging Heads land listening to this, take note. You're getting advice from a veteran. And I think we should wrap it up. I mean, you know, it's a Valentine's Day package, and I think we could tie a bow on it and put it in the can.
Little hearts. Okay.
Okay. So thanks so much for talking with me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it too.